Accession number 26852, Reel 5.
Mr. Coop, Reel 5. Now, we talked about when you arrived at this camp in Gloucester Valley, sometime in June 1953. Now, what was the actual state of the war at the time? Because I believe it had just ended, despite the sporadic fire,
The war had actually ended. Now, how we were told that, I'm not quite sure, but it was an official thing there. I don't know what term was used. Was it an armistice? I think it was an armistice because it depended upon certain political changes. And I call to mind the idea that there was a line drawn across with a no man's land, and people were negotiating from there what the next steps were going to be. But certainly I understood, and I did experience for a short period, one or two incidents in which...
Now, hang on, but there were still some isolated shooting incidents.
That's what I was going to say. That's what I was going to say.
Sorry.
There were stories of people who had been on guard duty, had been found mutilated or dead. Stories of tented guardhouses which had been shot up, despite the fact that officially the war was, I suppose, in a state of armistice.
Now, what exactly, you'd moved into this camp.
Yes.
What exactly were you doing during the first period?
During the first period, we were settling down, getting ourselves acclimatized, getting ourselves into routines, which were very quickly established for a bandsman, because we had to entertain. But we also had to have the area and positions in which we could entertain from, and so we had to build a bandstand.
Tell me about that.
Oh, God, that was just sort of digging up the foundations, finding the wood, getting someone to design it, finding the materials which would put it all together, stand the weight of so many men standing on it with their instruments, not fall through, and to prepare a little tea garden around it with benches and park benches.
What do you mean by tea garden?
A place where people could come and sit, bring their sandwiches or whatever it was that they had, or what was supplied there, and be entertained by the band giving a concert. We had to build all that, level the ground, dig the piss holes. I was a superb digger of piss holes and concrete.
You built a latrine?
We had to build a latrine.
Tell us about that, then. How did you build the latrine?
Well, as I remember, we dug these very deep trenches over which rafters were put, and then floorboards, and then the boxes out of which ammunition had been carried, with a hole cut suitably in it for you to sit on, was the actual main lavatory that you crept in. You can imagine what was happening underneath all this, and the smell that rose from it was appalling.
Was there any chemicals used?
Not that I remember.
And how often would it be moved?
Modern. Just left to finish. It was very, very deep hole.
It
was enormous. Oh, yes.
Now, what about this routine you set yourself into? What do you remember of that?
The actual routine would have been rising. We were actually, as a band, camped on the other side of the river. It was the river that ran through this Gloucester Valley from Cummoxan, the mountain, down to the River Ingen. And we were camped on one side of the river, and the regiment was camped on the other. And apparently the reason for this is because we were supposed to be in a bad influence on the other soldiers. So they kept us reasonably apart.
You're talking about the daily routine.
The daily routine began with the normal routines of practice. Band practice as a group. We had to rehearse also as an individual small orchestra and jazz band and entertainers, because when the weather closed in, and the weather there was extraordinary, extreme, we were the only ones that could get around. We went by the helicopters to the various places that needed our services. And we played for the different groups, the Australians, the Belgians, the Danish people. I think there were some Turkish men there. It was a Commonwealth and European brigade. It wasn't just the English.
Now tell me about the concert performances. How was it organised? I mean, would you go around by helicopter?
Yes, at night. We were the only ones who could get around because the weather closed in. Nobody could bloody move by road. It was impossible.
Well, tell us about the weather first, then. What was the weather like?
When we got there first, we were unwarned about what it was going to be like. And people got their instruments out. And trumpeters put the mouthpiece to the mouth and it froze. It was freezing. And we were ill-equipped, which is not surprising because that seems to be a pretty tradition. We've heard about the lack of equipment for people in the present Gulf War as well. We had the similar sort of thing out there.
So what should you have had that you...
We should have had a winter tent and a winter outfit. We arrived in our ordinary, some of us in our summer kit. And always throughout the whole of my time there with a summer tent but with a winter petrol fire in it, which really wasn't good enough. It just did the job. We were eventually issued with clothing which was superb. And it's the only time I can think that any soldier's underpants have been on the secret list because we weren't to talk about it.
Now, tell me about this new uniform. What was so special about it? What was so good about it?
Well, I'm not sure that it was special in the ordinary sense, but there was felt under trousers, which went over your long john pants. The boots were meant for Arctic conditions, and they had socks and insoles in them, which were specifically designed for Arctic conditions. I fancy, as I'm telling you this, I'm probably breaking the Secrets Act already. We had gloves, which were, I think it was two pair of gloves, fitted one into the other, with a first finger slot to house your trigger finger when you needed it. So what was surprising about that was that in some cases the two gloves and the finger made it almost difficult for you to get it into the actual rifle holding to squeeze the trigger. So there was a design fault there, which was quite interesting. There was the balaclava helmets we wore, which were over felt helmets. So they were extremely warm. We had another pair of gloves which were strapped to your wrist. But if you were a musician playing a trombone, that might have been very good. But if you were playing a French horn or a clarinet, you still get your fingers frozen.
Now, let's get back. So... How would the concerts be organised? I mean, who would do the arrangements?
I don't know. We would get a request from somewhere in the office and we were told we're going to so-and-so and so-and-so one night. We'd meet at the helicopter pad and fly off.
Now, what were the trips? I mean, most people hadn't been on a helicopter.
No, they were quite amazing.
Still haven't. What were the helicopter trips like?
Frightening. They scared the shit out of me.
What was frightening about it?
Well, I'm sitting on the edge of the helicopter with my feet dangling through the edge, and I've got a piano behind me and a drum kit, and I'm strapped in, and everything's bloody shifting. If they don't keep the helicopter in a straight line, you can feel you probably wouldn't be, but you can feel that you're going to be sort of pushed out. We were coming through a valley which I remember distinctly was the valley between Kamakzan leading into the Gloucester Valley where we were camped. And it was thick fog. And the aircraft in front of us went down. And we could see this puff of terrifying red flame. And we went up and they rose in height and the mist dispersed for a while. We could see this thing burning below. And we flew over it and went back. As it happened, it wasn't one of our regiment or part of our band, but an appalling thing to happen.
How many flights would it take to move the... how many helicopters would it take to move the band?
One. Because it wasn't the band that went and did this. It was a small string quartet with jazz instruments. It could be converted from a small orchestra to a jazz band in no time at all.
So
it's only the small groups that could get around in the winter.
So tell me, who would perform? What was the composition of the band when you got, you know?
The composition of the orchestra was something like four violins, a clarinet, a trumpet, piano, drums. Varied a little bit, depending on what was going on.
I mean, of the ones who went out to other units, that would be a string quartet, would it?
It'd be four violins, viola, cello, clarinet, French horns, trumpets, and drums.
So that would what would go out.
Yes.
What about the piano?
Sometimes the piano.
So what would happen when he got there?
Well, you'd be told where you're going to be set up. You'd probably be privileged to have a supper, which you wouldn't have got when you were on ordinary duties. You did the job. You flew back.
What would the program be like? And what would the setup be like of the evening's performance?
Well, the setup was very often very civilized in somebody's mess. They played for the Danes. I think for the Danish people. We played for the Americans. Played a lot of Americans. That was always amusing. Because they had a building where the orchestra played, the small orchestra played in a platform high up on a wall, and you'd approach it. It was surrounded with a bars that you couldn't get out, nobody could get in. And people below started quite civilized ways of eating and drinking, and then moved into, I don't know whether they were taking drugs or not, but they were certainly taking things which made them very wild and able to fight. They were aggressive. I saw some of the techniques they used to produce alcohol, which they hadn't always got, and that was the first time I've ever seen cherry blossom boot paste melted and filtered through a loaf of bread, so it came out of the clear liquid. And
did it. Well, the Americans did that.
Americans did it. Mixed with Coca-Cola, this was a very fine drink. It gave people a lot of happiness, but caused a lot of fighting.
So these orchestra performances were done in front of quite a large. It wasn't just the officers' mess.
No. Sometimes we, for the regiment, did regular work for the officers' mess.
I'll come back to that. So these audiences weren't always quiet during your
performances. Oh, good God, no!
So what was a typical night like in front of them?
Well, very noisy.
Were you just background music then?
Sometimes it was just background music. Sometimes we were music that entertained as well. So we would fill in for people that they brought along, like their comedians and Marilyn Monroe came over.
What would you actually play?
You mean the actual music itself?
Yeah, when you went to Americans or the Turks or whatever.
Well, they often give us stuff which we had to play at sight, stuff that they did. But it would have been things like in the Monastery Garden was very popular with some of the British troops. The shows Call Me Madam and whatever it was, we would play extracts, you know, from their overtures and things like that.
So you wouldn't have a singer?
No, we didn't.
It was just a light orchestra.
Just a light orchestra music. Sometimes overtures that you'd find were popular, soupe, morning, noon, and night.
And would it go down well, usually? Or was it
true? Strangely enough, yes, it would. And it did. Because I think people needed the attention, and the music and the presence of the band produced a change in relationships.
And you were playing violin first. You were one of the four violins.
Yes.
Now, did you never sent the jazz band out on these things. So I would have thought the jazz band would
Jazz band did go out, but they went independently.
And you weren't in that?
No. Occasionally I played with it. But it wasn't my forte.
Now, what were the dues you did for the officers' mess like?
Well, they were always...
I mean, they'd be your own officers' mess.
They were always very formal.
Tell us what a typical
You'd start with something like... They had a routine of walking into the mess to a tune called The Roast Beef of Old England. We had to play them in. We would then play quietly throughout the meal so that they were sort of, it was background music to their eating. Most of the young men got, young officers got drunk very quickly. And some of them were abusive and a bloody nuisance.
In what way?
Well, they come and demand to take your instrument just to play with it. So they tell us all how brilliant they were, of course. My instrument was my own personal instrument. It wasn't a war officer's instrument. And I very often got into abrasive difficulties with some young men who wanted to, who couldn't understand that. I'm not giving you my instrument. Sorry, you know. You can imagine what military command can do like that. So that caused some problems, occasionally. We had a padre who would give regular sermons on how we should behave, never get drunk and all that sort of, but he used to get sloshed regularly on liqueur chocolates, which I found quite nice, he's a pleasant guy. He also burnt his tone down regularly because he couldn't handle the fire. I think the Theo got pissed off with his. Then you get, oh, the sergeants must be occasionally played to them as well. Of course.
Tell us about that.
Well, there was a different kettle of fish. They had their own formalities, and they would play a lot of physical games. One of the revolting but extraordinary game was you'd have piles of potatoes at each end of the room. And you'd have to rush up. Your team member would have to rush up, sit on the pile, pick up a potato with the cheeks of his arse, and run to the other end and drop it in the bucket. Oh, that's sort of relay. They got points for the number of potatoes they dropped on the way, calculated against the number of successes they got of drilling trouble in the bucket. Very often this led to fights, quite violent fights, which I found quite surprisingly difficult to accept, because you see these guys on parade the following day. Smart, effective characters, good warriors, good men, but during the night you just see them at the playful, boyish worst.
Now, what about the, you mentioned that you had some big stars. Well, you mentioned Marilyn Monroe.
Well, I'll tell you one star that I really, really appreciated to this day, and that was Bob Monkhouse.
Tell me about that.
Well, I met him for the first time in a tent in Korea, and he came in with other comedians, other entertainers, and I think he was just sat for about 24 hours. It's a very, very long time. I don't think I'm exaggerating. And he just told jokes, one after the other, after the other. And he gave people an energy just to overcome the great difficulties that were being placed before us there. He was a man of enormous personality and technique. Humorous, talented, and a man of his time, presence. It was, to be in his presence was to feel you're in the presence of somebody of goodwill. I really sort of appreciated his. We played for one of his concerts. It happened twice, actually. And we'd done all the rehearsals, and the BBC orchestra, who was supposed to have done it in the evening, eventually turned up and took the job over from us. So we couldn't get into the actual performance. And he was walking along outside the area and saw us standing by and said, "What the hell are you doing there?" We explained to him that we weren't playing anymore and we couldn't get in. And he went in and got two brooms, came back and told us all to sweep down the aisle, and we got down to the far end of the... put the booth down, sit down. And he realised immediately that anybody who was doing a job like that was not going to be challenged. And it was nice. Clever man.
Who else came out?
I don't really remember any names. Oh, there was some of the women singers whose names I've completely forgotten.
What about Marilyn Monroe? Did she?
Well, she turned up for the Yanks, and we had to turn up on. We were the only band out there. Full military band, about 60 to 80 people on parade. I was there with a clarinet. Corps of drums, waiting for her plane to land. Of course, she was late and late and late. And it was raining, we got pissed off. When she eventually arrived, she was hustled away as fast as could be in cars. So we played her in, but we hardly ever saw her there. What amazed me was when I eventually got to the Yankee stadium where she had done her act, and it was now a common room of some type. They got a full-size picture of her with that famous billowing skirt against the wall. It was bolted to the wall. It was covered and fixed by grills, so it couldn't be got out. And two men, one on either side, stood on guard with fixed bayonets to prevent anybody trying to pinch the bloody picture, I presume. But that's my memories of.
So anybody else? That's it as far as you remember?
That's as far as I can remember. I know others did come.
Now, what were living conditions like for you when you settled in?
When we actually settled in, we got into a routine which made life possible.
But what was it?
Well, the thing is, you had to make sure that your fire was on all the time and it was safe. If the fire went out in the winter, it was Arctic conditions, you were in dead trouble.
This is in the huts, you mean?
It wasn't a hut. We didn't have any huts. We had summer tents and winter fires. So the fires were petrol. Fed.
They were sort of heaters, or stoves.
There were stoves that stood about 2 foot, 1 foot 6, 2 foot in diameter, and stood about 2 foot 6, 3 foot high. They had to be fed fuel at a proper rate, had to be lit at the correct rate. And the chimney went up to the tent, and there was an area on the tent which was fireproof, so that the heat from the chimney could not set the tent alight. But you can imagine, if anything went wrong, how many tents got burnt down and how many people were injured because of this, and quite a lot were.
Did you ever have a fire? Or?
Not in mine, but I think people have them.
So that was one part. One part of the routine was you had to keep this going. Was there any shortage of petrol? Or was
there? Yes, there was occasionally. If you ran out, you're in dead trouble. The other thing you had in my particular area was the Songo rat, which was as big as a bloody hairy terrier. And the rumour was, if you got bit by one of those buggers, you were in the hospital for a very, very long time. And because we had a little camp away from the regiment, we were able to deal with that in our own way. Anybody who saw a Songo rat at any time, night or day, would blow the bugle call to arms, and everybody had a, because a lot of these guys were Indian Army that I was working with. Out you got, straight into the passageway, find where the bloody rat was, and you played hockey with it. And wrapped it all over the bloody place. And yeah, it was part of your enjoyment. But they were enormous.
How were they a nuisance? Were they just a threat rather than knowing, or did they actually do anything?
If they actually bit you, you were in trouble.
But did they?
The rumour was yes, and the rumour was that some people had gone stark staring bonkers. No proof that this was the case.
But were there many of them about? I mean, was it a plague?
Well, when we got there first, it was maybe 4 or 5 in the first week.
So a fair number.
I remember being left behind because we had been, the small orchestra had been out doing work, and it was, you know, the weather was changing and whatever it was, and the band was out. The big marching band was gone away, and we slept in the tent comfortably for once, because we had only 3 or 4 of us in this tent. And Bodger Millward, the drummer, woke up and told us that he'd seen this bloody Sangha rat during the night. And I remember him saying, it was this size, that size, whatever it was, demonstrating with him. And then he put his hand on the side of it, and it was just there. And I saw him freeze and his face go dark marble white because he put his hand on the rat. Then he screamed. Did a neck roll down the middle of the aisle. And gone.
When you say aisle, you mean between the tents?
The wall of the tent would come up and meet the roof of the tent like that. And there was a little space between the two. And he put his hand on that space. That's where I saw the rat, he says. And then he was gone, like a shot.
Any other problems? Any other ways you had to get used to? Things you had to get used to?
Well, yes. I didn't swim. But getting washed and changed in clean water was not easy. But as I say, that in Gloucester Valley, from the mountain Kamaksan down towards the Imogen, there was a tributary. And what we did was twofold. But we blocked that stream up so that we had some space to get into the water. Well, I didn't swim. Soon bloody learned to swim because we used that pool of water which we built there purely for ourselves. We could swim in it, we could bathe in it, we could enjoy it. It was very, very important because it kept us clean. And it also amused us and it produced good human relationships because we had fun there.
Was there anything you had to watch out for in the water?
Yes. There was an infection called Imogen ear. That's what the medicals called it. And if you got that, it was a self-inflicted wound and you could only get it from the water.
And how could you prevent it, though?
You couldn't. But you had to take a risk of it. And you had to keep clean, put cotton wool in your ears and do things like that. There was also wildlife in the water. I remember, I could doggy paddle. I couldn't swim very well. But I remember going along, paddling away, and a bloody great snake coming towards me on the top. And I remember diving down to avoid it, and it dived down to avoid me, and I could feel it slithering past. There's stories told about some of the small wildlife out there, poisonous snakes and things like that. We had caught a lot of these. And buried oil drums in the ground. To entertain ourselves, we would put these bloody animals in there, snakes, and put frogs in and things like that to bet on how quickly they could disappear. Very cruel things, but it was a cruel life.
Were the snakes a problem in any way? Were you aware of any poisonous types?
I was told there were poisonous ones. I don't know whether there was. I remember a band corporal who wasn't very popular, but had been put in charge of one of the rooms where our instruments and equipment was stored, a room of the tent, and sounds a bit cartoonish, but it's true. He put his foot in his boot one morning to find there was a snake in it. And then when we actually got in to hear him, because the noise was appalling, he was up the pole of the tent at the top, hanging on like a bit like some kind of Tom and Jerry cartoon.
But were they actually poisonous?
I don't know. I think people just were frightened. It was just ignorance. I simply don't know.